Okay, thank you very much for the invitation. So when I was preparing the talk, I thought about possible titles. And this is sort of the conservative title that I came up with at the end. The other title I had in mind was like, do we have a good notion of equivalence of gauge theories in the presence of boundaries? But actually, probably the given the beauty of the talks before, the appropriate title is sometimes things can go wrong, and this is the case of general relativity. And right, so in fact, what I would like to point out is some observational data, I would say, that we have found when trying to apply the BV formalism with boundary to the, let's say, old cases of general relativity, but still very interesting,
sorry,
I would say.
I didn't get that.
What did he say? So, was that a question?
Yes, he didn't get it.
Right, so then, okay, so what I will present here is by examples, some observational data where the BV-BFV formalism somehow fails, but this tells us something interesting, possibly, about the theories that we're looking at. And I think this raises the question of whether theories that we consider to be equivalent before are indeed equivalent, to which extent, right? So let me first start with, well, I guess the standard notion of equivalence of theories, of classical equivalence, right? So I will not give definitions because, well, I don't even know if there are, but essentially what people do in general is they assign to a manifold M a space of classical fields, together with an action functional, on this space of fields, and possibly a distribution whose vector fields annihilate the action. So these would be the symmetries. So then we have the critical locus of this action functional. So solutions to the order Lagrange equations. And roughly we want to, so what we want to look at is somehow this space up to symmetries, right? So we want to make sense of let me say, like, some version of this, whatever that means. And when we're given two such data, so we have F S dm on this side, and prime S prime dm prime on the other side, the statement is that we kind of want to compare this space with this space, right? So we want to establish some sort of relationship between, well, whatever this is here and whatever that is there. Okay, so already in the 80s and probably even before, people started realizing that the notion, that this notion is somehow too weak. And in fact, they gave a sort of definition, which is like two theories are solution equivalent when something like this happens. So when I can describe the critical locus in the two theories, somehow I know how to compare them up to symmetries, or in the case where symmetries are not present.
As symplectic objects?
Right, good question. Probably not. Like just as
it's not symplectic.
Yeah, this is not symplectic in general, so.
It's pre-symplectic.
Pardon?
It is pre-symplectic.
Well, no, not well. Yeah, the critical locus. Well, but you need to give a symplectic structure, right? So
it
what
comes
is?
Comes with the action.
Why?
Yes.
When it's.
Well, you have to. This is, so for instance, take the cotangent bundle, and then you can.
No, it's called Hovarian formalism. If you have a critical locus,
right?
It always that comes from an action principle.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you can say something about the critical locus, but yeah, so. Yes, so you can canonically extend to a symplectic manifold, and then you can see it as a pre-symplectic manifold, and then you can state the equivalence in that case. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is that the other notion of equivalence, which is probably what you are saying is, exactly, is when the canonical structures coincide. Okay, so you construct a Poisson bracket here, and then you show that the Poisson brackets in the two theories coincide. And what I would like to argue today is that essentially this notion here is related to the boundary structure that we will try to construct.
So you're only considering the equivalence up to Euler Lagrange equation, so only that classical.
I mean, this is one way you can think of equivalence of theories, and this is what is done many times, right? So for instance, here you might have more fields and more equations, right? You take a subset of those equations, you solve them, and then you compute the action on those solutions. And then you establish a sort of equivalence between that submanifold in the space of fields and the original space you had before.
Would, yes. Would you also require that this equivalence holds locally on space-time? It's like a sheaf?
Well, no. I mean, this is not even a definition. So this is I'm just trying to explain what is usually done, right? So usually you have a space of fields, you have an action, and then you want to try to make sense of the critical locus here and there and say that they describe the same thing.
And you have several levels of approximation.
Yes.
So these are the coarser thing.
Exactly. So this is
going to be V, which means that you describe these in terms of the DG symplectic manifold, you want these to be polyisomorphic.
Exactly. In fact the appropriate notion would be if you can find the BV theory here and there, and then you want to ask that the two BV theories be quasi-isomorphic. That would be the appropriate notion. But for some reason, this is not.
It's hampered by local transformation.
Right.
To preserve the sheaf structure.
Exactly. Okay, so. Give me one second. So, however, so this level, this is also only classical. There is no quantum structure here. I'm not trying to quantize the theory. And that will be important because if you want to establish equivalence and non-equivalence of theories, you might want to entertain the thought that two theories might be equivalent classically, but not at the quantum level. And this is also information that you might want to keep, right? So, right. So on top of that, if your manifold does have a boundary, okay, and even if you assume that you have this BV quasi-isomorphism between what you have on the left and what you have on the right, this need not induce assertive equivalence on the boundary structure as well. And we will see some examples of that. So first example I would like to present is one-dimensional gravity coupled to a scalar field or matter or whatever. Oh, actually, yeah, sorry, just do matter. So the action we consider where the fields are, well, let's say Rn. G is just a positive function. And, right, so F of E will be just, well, what I wrote. So this T is just the kinetic energy. Well, we assume, well, okay, so this is just a standard pairing in there. Now, so G is a positive function that you might think of, and this will be important in a second, you might think of the coefficient of a metric on the interval. Okay.
What is there V and E?
Pardon? What's So this V is a V of Q, is a potential, and E is just a parameter.
E is a cosmological constant?
Yeah, you can think of it as a cosmological constant one because.
Energy.
Yeah. But for us, it's just a parameter, and yeah, it has these two interpretations. Okay, so you take the variation of this, and from here, well, I will not do the computations, you get that the Euler Lagrange equations, they are given by this. Mm-hmm. Right. So what I said before is that you take a subset of these equations, namely you take this, and then you compute Sg of Q and then this particular solution. What you get? This action, which we will call Sj, and this is the Jacobi action for reparametrization invariant classical mechanics.
It's a Jacobi action for classical mechanics
at
fixed energy.
At fixed energy, well, yeah, fixed given this energy. So you interpret E as the energy, and well, it's a parameter, but it's, well, you fix it, and then the extremal point of this action will be just like the trajectories, but without the parametrization. Okay, so according to the usual language, these two theories are classically equivalent. Okay, notice that we have discarded all boundary terms. For the moment, we will analyze those later, but it's just to say that this happens. Now, so both theories are reparametrization invariants in the sense that there is an action of the group of diffeomorphisms of the interval, which leaves the action invariant. And therefore we can promote this to a BB theory. So we construct a Q operator by just declaring that it acts by Lie derivative on fields. And on itself as well. And Xi is, as customary, say degree one vector field on the interval. And then we can construct the BV extension by just saying that S G slash I, well, let me write it. Well, so this will be S G zero plus G dagger Lxi G, Q dagger Lxi Q, Xi dagger Lxi Xi, and yep.
Could you equally switch G to actually being a metric?
Pardon?
The first line?
Say it again.
Yes, you interpret G.
Yeah, you interpret G now as a metric. I mean, this. So here I wrote it like this, but actually you should think of it as a symmetric positive then section of the example I. Yeah, okay, so this is very similar. On the shifted cotangent bundle of F, G, or J times vector fields over the interval. Okay. So now the claim is that if you apply, so we apply the BV BFV analysis. Well, maybe I should underline this. What this means is that so if we call this F, G, or J, right? We want to find a triple. L, G, or J, such that in a map pi, G, or J from F to this, with the properties, this is just recalling what the BVBFV structure should give you as an input property, that there is a cohomological vector field. Well, I will drop the GJ, okay, it's clear, such that pi of q there is precisely this q boundary. And instead, the master equation in the bulk is spoiled by a boundary term. So this is the data we would like to get. Yes?
Can I ask what straight line f g mod j is? In the left-hand side of the bottom right
here?
Equation. Upstairs there?
Yeah.
Yeah, that.
Here?
Yeah, exactly.
So this f is just, well, I call it fi.
F of g or f.
Yeah, f of g or f of j. So this is g, and this is just Jacobi j.
So you're considering
right.
both sides.
I'm just,
yeah.
Just at the same time. Otherwise.
Capital omega is different from Alberto's talk. That's just the
capital omega is just a BV.
Yeah.
It's the canonical symplectic form on the shifted cotangent bundle. Maybe I should write it here. So this comes equipped with omega g j, which is just, where are you? There. Which is just the shifted, the minus one shift, the symplectic structure in here.
That was what Alberto called little omega. Okay.
Was it little?
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
I think you were doing the week.
Pardon?
I think you were doing the week.
Yeah, yeah. Also, things can go wrong, right? Okay, so the first claim is that for 1D gravity, so everything that has a G, so sub G, that thing works. So there is a BV, BFV structure or manifold, depending on the definition you want to use. Well, let me say structure. Or that this BV data for G induces a BFV data compatible in this sense. So S boundary is given by an expression that I should remember, but I don't. Should be somewhere. Yeah. V square 2m plus V of q minus E c, where pi of g is the map that tells me what these things are, over square root of g, q dagger psi, b, that we don't see there, but it's just and c, it's this expression. And F boundary, G, is the cotangent bundle of, well, it's some cotangent bundle of R n cross R 1, right?
N, what is n? N is the number of scalars.
This n?
Yeah, yeah,
it's the target. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. So omega boundary G is essentially just the P PQ plus D D D C.
So these are zero dimensional integers.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's formally on the boundary of I, right?
So Q is still the coordinate on R n.
Pardon?
Q is still the coordinate on R n.
Yes.
P is its momentum.
This is the momentum, which is described by this. And look, I mean, this is essentially the right thing you would expect, but it's corrected by the BV structure.
And B and C are the
translation. The ghost for translations.
So yeah, C is the ghost for translations, but it's rescaled by this square root of G, and B it's its momenta.
Could I interpret this as choosing a gauge in which the metric is constant, and I have residual gauge symmetry?
You are fixing the metric in a sort of controlled way, right?
I mean, there's only one metric on the interval.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I just pick that metric. Mm-hmm. I still have some gauge symmetry, just translation, and you're gauging it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what's going on?
I'm not sure that I'm really gauging anything here. I mean, not in the actual sense.
I mean, you're dividing your space of fields by translation. That's what gauging means.
Well, I mean, yes. But I'm also resolving that, right?
Was it?
I mean, so essentially what this is telling you is that you are resolving this constraint in this space.
Uh-huh.
Right.
By gauging, I just mean in the BV formalism, you introduce fields.
Yeah.
For that gauge symmetry, and that they're present in your phase space, or shifted by one, and it's cotangent.
You don't have a metric on the boundary anymore. So yeah, in a way, you are somehow getting rid of it. But is that what you would call a gauge? I mean.
Choosing the gauge in the boundary structure?
No.
It's not a gauge in the sense of a Lagrangian submanifold in the space.
There's two meanings of gauge.
Right.
You fix a gauge,
yes.
And then you have some residual gauge symmetry.
Yes.
And you divide by that. You gauge it in the other sense of gauging. You
right.
Come to your gauge fields for it.
Possibly.
In the boundary.
Well, I mean, in a little interval.
Yes.
If it's, you get the same formula, let's see.
On the boundary.
Yeah, we should check that, but we can try to do that. What is interesting is that this does not happen if you take this BV extension. So if you consider the Jacobi theory in its BV formulation, and you try to induce a compatible BFV structure, this will fail. So in particular, and I will move on in a second, in particular what happens is that if you take F Jacobi, you can construct this F check that we discussed in Alberto's talk. And what you would like to do, so here on this space, you have a natural two form, which is D of A check Jacobi, right? And this comes from integration by parts. And then you want to look at the kernel of this omega check. And tentatively, you would like to define the quotient.
Maybe on the previous board, so what's the logic? So this pi is the projection to the boundary.
Yes, so this here I'm constructing a section of that projection.
So are these formulas somehow guessed or are they constructed?
No, you can construct them.
You start from the boundary field, you construct the ground field. Your BV structure is broken, so you construct this F check. You pull out by the kernel, and
so you essentially use this kernel constructively to produce this section here.
So why usually we get very simple formulas and here we get complicated formulas?
Because this is a complicated theory.
You get very simple formula in AZ.
Yes. So why is there a complicated formula? So, I mean,
well, it's not like AZ too.
I mean,
yes, but what in particular causes this?
So in general, you don't expect. You have this universal construction that you can apply, which in first order formalism is usually a bit easier to interpret, and AKZ theory is obvious.
No, but notice
this
something.
Is not,
I mean,
second order and not AKZ.
All of these constructions, they well, apart from this, probably, it depends on this xi, which is the normal vector field at the boundary, right? Well, normal, it's pointing inwards. And this is something, this is a crucial feature of diffeomorphism invariants. And this you will see happening in general relativity in a second. So essentially what happens here is that this is not regular enough, so we cannot mod out by it, and so we don't have this.
So it's okay if you work in the derived setting, in the sense you don't care that this is not
right.
Well,
it's not degenerate on the nose.
Yeah. So we.
Yeah, the point that you want to really, the point that in the other format, like in most field theory, you can get a nice presentation where the symplectic stroke is strictly non-degenerate.
Right.
Here you have to. You cannot.
Exactly. So the point is that given this, you might try to find solutions to solve this problem, or you can stop and start thinking like what actually you're doing. So do you really want to consider this? You really want to resolve this, or you prefer to work with smooth objects? So this is up to you, of course. But well, for how it's constructed, the formalism breaks down here. And then you might ask yourself why, and if there is like a deeper reason. Okay, so I think I'm done with a simple example. Maybe later today in the discussion I can say something more about it, because it's actually very rich. But yeah, let's get to something more interesting or juicy or lengthy to write down. So now I want to look at the case of general relativity in the Einstein-Hilbert formulation. So in a nutshell, this is pick a manifold M, and then you consider pseudo-Riemannian matrix signature D1. So we're doing it in D dimensions, and D has to be different from 1. We'll see. Over M. Okay. So G. But actually, so we found out that the way that the computations are, like the way to simplify the computations is to assume that G has no light-like directions on the boundary. This you can think of as the condition that the boundary be space-like or time-like, but notice this is a condition on the space of fields, but it's a mild condition. So if that is the case, then we can write down the action as, in this new set of coordinates, okay, where these are just functions, and this is a metric, this denotes a metric on the boundary. Right, so gamma for simplicity will be a Riemannian metric on the boundary. Okay.
Where is G? Where is gamma?
So G is in the bulk, so it's in the D plus one dimensional manifold.
You're assuming that you have a foliation.
No, I don't assume that. I assume that I have a foliation just in the neighborhood of the boundary.
So what is the decomposition you're using?
This is in the neighborhood of the boundary. It's ADM. This is the standard ADM decomposition,
okay,
but in the neighborhood of the boundary.
Beta is the excessive curvature?
Pardon? No, beta is the shift, and this is the lapse.
Lapse
and the shift. So this is completely standard. Yeah. So I'm not doing anything special here. But yeah, as you mentioned it.
Are you considering like a finite region?
or regionally in an asymptotic, does the bark extend all the way to space like infinity?
No, so you consider a closed boundary in your manifold, and that's it. So that around that boundary, you consider a neighborhood, and
so
in that
like a corner.
No, you don't
so
need to.
So this version of M is just a manifold with boundary.
Yeah, it's a manifold with boundary.
No, but he's asking, what is the topology of delta M?
It's a closed manifold.
It's a closed manifold. So
closed compact manifold.
Yeah. Okay.
In this example, it's just a manifold with boundary, so the boundary is a closed manifold.
Yeah.
But so you can try to extend this to manifold.
Sure.
But the boundary is all space-like.
Well, which means that that condition is a condition on the field. So the field when the metric when restricted to the boundary has to be space-like or time-like, right? Because the boundary is a topological information, right? So you don't have notion of space-like. If you just have topology, right? Right. Sorry. Okay, so you define, the extrinsic curvature is given by this combination. Whoops. And we use the ADM action, which is given by the following formula. Do I have it here? Yeah. So that's zero ADM. This is our action, where K is defined there. It depends on the metric in this complicated way. Okay, so now we extend this action to its BV extension. So we let diffeomorphisms act by Lie derivatives again. Okay. And the action we will consider will be the classical degree zero action plus the usual pairing. Well, so our space of BV fields will be just pseudo Riemannian matrix with this condition on the boundary, signature D1 cross vector fields, and then shift the cotangent bundle.
The metric is not supposed to be light-like on the boundaries, but the vector fields are
unrestricted. Okay, so, with this data, the result is that this goes through. You can define, that data. And the canonical omega induces a BV, BFV structure on DM, which looks like, it's E ADM, SADM, and omega small ADM, where, okay, so omega ADM, one sec, is just d pi d gamma, where pi is the sum, well, maybe I should write what this is first. This is the cotangent bundle of Riemannian metrics on the boundary cross vector fields on the boundary of degree one cross functions of degree one on the boundary. The coordinates will be called gamma, psi del, psi n, and the dual coordinates will be called pi, phi delta, and phi n. So this is just, well, whatever. All right. And what is more interesting maybe is to have a look at the boundary action. And this will be given by following expression. Sorry, this is a bit complicated, but it will be interesting, I believe. Cyan. This is a boundary action for Einstein-Hilbert in d plus one dimensions. Observe one thing. So if you consider xi n and xi del as Lagrange multipliers, this is just a statement that we're looking at the zeros of these two functions.
Sorry, what are h?
So these are complicated functions. Okay, of T star R. And these are what usually are called the canonical constraints. So if this is what it's called the Hamiltonian constraint, and this is the momentum constraint. The rest is gauge symmetry. It's a residual gauge symmetry that you have on the fields here. Okay, so we're happy this works, and then this is sort of the preparation for possibly BDBFE quantization, but you know, like, that's hard.
Sorry, what's written there? It's a gamma minus one, then phi delta, and?
D xi n. So xi n is a function, and then you take its, well, differential. And then, so right. So this you can interpret as a symmetric bivector. So it has inputs to one forms. This is a density valued one form, and then you can integrate.
And this is the boundary action.
Yes, this is a boundary action, which is somehow stating that the BFE structure is resolving this coisotropic submanifold up to gauge equivalence, and the gauge equivalence is here.
This is what you would call the Hamiltonian.
Right, but I'm confused because it's not
the name, the Hamiltonian. That's what you would call the
Hamiltonian. It's the Hamiltonian up to symmetry, yeah.
So there's no symplectic term, because usually there's a difference between the Lagrangian and the Hamiltonian, which is the symplectic term.
No, it's just the Hamiltonian.
Okay.
This is usual.
It's called the action, but it's the Hamiltonian.
Okay.
Sometimes you call it the BRST charge. You can also call it BRST charge if you prefer.
And he just said that you have the canonical constraints and it tells how the symmetry.
Yes. So if you take the derivative,
usually you would act as a gradient.
Right. So the statement. So you have the statement Q delta omega delta is the S delta. This is a Hamiltonian function of the cohomological vector field on the boundary, and this will have inside the constraints and the gauge transformations. In fact, gauge transformations here are interesting. I don't have time, maybe later. So it's essentially diffeomorphisms on the boundary twisted by the action of these function degree one functions, which should be interpreted as somehow evolution in the transversal direction. Now, okay, good, so this works. This works, but it's you know, hard to handle as people already know. And okay, so we stop here for a second. Now, the other formulation is what it's called tetradic Palatini formulation of GR. The way it works is essentially in 4D, sorry, thank you, in four dimensions.
Before it was any dimension. So.
Yeah, right. So before, yeah, there is also that problem. So you consider a bundle map where this is essentially Minkowski space on all fibers. Okay. And then you consider an SO31 bundle. Bundle over M and a connection, let me call it A, which should be the associated bundle to this vector bundle curly V. Okay, and the action we consider. So the action we consider is just like some trace of E, wedge the curvature of A. This trace, so just a quick remark, you can identify the algebra SO31 with wedge 2 of V, and then this is just a volume form in wedge 4. Okay? For people who know what I'm talking about, this can be endowed with the Barbera-Mirzi parameter if you want, but you don't need to. And in fact, it will be independent of that. But I will say it will be independent of that. But this is just a volume form in wedge 4 of V. So again, the Euler-Lagrange equations for this theory are just E wedge F of A equals 0 and E wedge PAE equals 0. Now in the bulk, this is equivalent to dAE equals 0, which is equivalent to saying that A is fixed as a function of E. Okay, and then when you include this equation in the game and you consider this, then this will be equivalent to Einstein equation.
Assuming he's not a degenerate.
Yes. Yeah, sorry, that's important. Yeah.
Yeah, what are the gauge symmetries here?
Right, I'll be there in a second. This is just Einstein equation. So you can say that this theory is classically equivalent, at least up to boundary terms, to Einstein-Hilbert theory. Indeed, if you consider this field redefinition, then you can pull back this action precisely to R of G. R of G, where G is defined using the tetrad, it's just like E, G mu nu is E mu A, eta A B, E nu B, okay? Okay, so now coming to your question, what are the gauge symmetries here? Well, the gauge symmetries are all diffeomorphisms plus some internal SO31 gauge symmetry. Okay, so we have this this result that if you define Q to be given by the following, Q of C is 1/2 xi f of A minus cc. Q of psi is just del psi psi, then this Q squares to 0, squares to 0. And of course, C is a function of the manifolds with values in which 2 of V, or G, G if you prefer. And the rest is defined. Again, E is considered to be a one form with values in curly B. And psi is a degree one vector field. This is also degree one. Of M. And A, let me write it again. It's a connection on P. Okay, so if you consider this and you sum, then you get F curly Palatini, take the cotangent of that, this will be, this will be your BV space of fields. Right, so you take these things, you dualize. Okay, so you probably already know what I'm going to say, but so the data F Palatini S Palatini in the BV framework with the standard omega Palatini and Q. This does not induce a BV BFE theory on the boundary.
What do you mean by the strict sense?
I mean, in this derived geometry, you require the non-degeneracy of the symplectic form up to homotopy. Whereas,
so the symplectic, you mean the omega d, when you mean the symplectic geometry, the symplectic structure?
Yes.
In the phase space.
In the phase space. Whereas, so here, whereas here we are looking for models in which you, which the symplectic structure is strict, it's non-degenerate. In the strict sense, not long out. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So what is the kernel? What is the form of the kernel there?
Well, the kernel is okay. I can give you the kernel in the classical the degree zero part, but the kernel in the BV extended is complicated. It's a very complicated expression. I'll have it written down, but essentially you can see that it jumps from one point to another, so it's not a subbundle of the tangent bundle.
Could you qualify what you mean by that? What does it mean, jumps? Like the kernel?
So you want it to
rank of the kernel.
You want it to be constant rank in some sense.
Okay, so it jumps depending on the value of some fields, even if the metric is non-degenerate.
Well, that is an assumption that you do from the beginning.
And the jump is due to?
It's due to the ghosts, in fact. If you do it in the classic, so if you take the degree zero part of this, mm-hmm. So in degree zero, you can describe the space of boundary fields, and this is the cotangent bundle. How can I write? Well, let me write it like this. It's the cotangent bundle of one forms on the boundary with values in V. And these are the restricted tetrads, right? So this is E to the boundary. Okay? Now the cotangent field is A Non-degenerate still, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, right. So these are the restrictions of non-degenerate objects on the boundary. So, but these, this doesn't even mean you don't have a notion of non-degeneracy here. So A will be a connection on the induced principal bundle over the boundary. But it will have to have a property that, how can I, well, okay, so essentially the symplectic form will be just E, dE, dA. Mm-hmm. But you can show that this is not everything. So you killed something. So there was some non-trivial kernel here. In fact, so if A, you're right, you can split in this way, where A hat is a one form on the boundary with values in wedge 2 of V, so it's a linearization. Then the condition is that A hat wedge E is 0. So you're killing these shifts on the metric. And what you're left with is the cotangent field. And in fact, I mean, let me just say to conclude that, okay, so this is a non-trivial condition, and the fact that in general expressions, the fact that E is not invertible anymore on the boundary, because, well, it's an object, it's a three-dimensional, object on a three-dimensional space with values in a four-dimensional space, This will play a key role. As a last comment, I want to say that if you keep on looking at the classical part, the degree zero part of it, and you try to look at the classical canonical constraints of the theory, which means you restrict the Euler-Lagrange equations to the boundary. So take the other Lagrange equations in the bulk and you restrict them to the boundary for this Palatini version. Okay. Then you expect this to give you a coisotropic submanifold. Because this happens in all known theories. For instance, it happens in the Einstein-Hilbert case, where these are precisely this Hn and H delta that I wrote before. But in Palatini, this object is not quasiotropic. So this is not quasiotropic.
So by that you mean there is second class constraints?
Well, I don't want to get into that now. So let's talk about it later. Mm-hmm. But essentially, let me just say that this is a first like alarm bell that says maybe something is going wrong. And in fact, you can make it coisotropic, but you have to require a strict condition on the fields. So if you require that on the boundary, so on Vn, this is E exact, then you might have a chance to recover everything. This is not obvious. This is a closed, it's a very strong conditions on the space of fields, and then you might ask like what this actually means. So in general, as we discussed, this is assumed. It's secretly assumed somewhere. Mm-hmm. And
even worse, I'm not there is no. I mean, you have a nice way to write these constraints before doing these reductions and then here in the physics setting, but the constraints are not Hamiltonian.
Yes, so there is one constraint in particular, the Hamiltonian, the so-called Hamiltonian constraint, which is not even, so it's a function on the space of fields on the boundary, on the pre-boundary, but it's not Hamiltonian. It doesn't have a Hamiltonian vector field. And that is another alarm sign that something is somehow maybe to be understood. So just a concluding remark. So this is a failure of the construction, but we should think of this as maybe giving us some more information on the theory and giving us a way to correct the way we look at the theory in order to make it work. If we were able to make it work, then this might give us a different quantization.
So I thought you're going to tell me, therefore, the next step is to take Ashtekar-Sen self-dual connection, which essentially kind of addresses in one go all this issue.
Can I stop here and then answer your question? Okay.
Is open for questions.
So can I answer your question? Yes, you can.
This is the roadblock that
so you can do that, and this is work in progress with Alberto and his student Giovanni Canepa. Essentially what happens is that yes, you can rephrase boundary Einstein-Hilbert, okay, in a triadic way. So in the gamma, you write as the pullback of, let me call it T, a triad, right? Notice that this is not that thing, right? Okay, and then you can try, you rephrase the constraints. They will be well-defined in this new setting. You will get a different symplectic structure, though. Okay? It's a different symplectic structure. And then what do? You can try to construct a four-dimensional theory out of that data. So essentially, you can do a KSC for cylinders. So you do a KSC, sorry. You can do a KSC where your source is interval and you're mapping into the space of boundary fields for this new theory. And then you construct the AKSC action. Well, I don't want to get into the details. But if you do that, essentially you're doing Ashtekar for cylinders. And this seems, but we haven't gone to the last, the final word yet, seems to be inequivalent to this. Because essentially you get a SO3 Palatini formulation instead of an SO3-1. So you can reconstruct the normal object, this EN, which is what you're missing here. So these things you can think of A, where A is the tangent index to the boundary. So you can make sense of this in some way. And so you extend to a cylinder, a four-dimensional space, but you will still have a symmetry-broken Palatini version.
Well, I think there's a difference between the in the Riemannian case, you're perfectly correct, that what you get is SO3 and not SO4. But in the Lorentzian case, you have to complexify. Self-duality is a complex. So what you get is SL2C instead of SO3-1. So
but
at the quantum level, that's, you know, the point is that we don't know how to quantize complex actions, but at the classical level, in the Lorentzian.
Well, what I could tell you, but this is very hand-wavy, is that okay. you know very well that you can trade the complexification with the Barbero-Mirzi connection, the Ashtekar-Barbero-Mirzi.
I think that's a subtlety. Now, the complexification it's way more natural than the Barbero-Mirzi.
Anyway, the gist of this is that every step has to be checked, right?
I mean, it's like in Young Mills, right? If you complexify and work with self-dual variables, that goes back to, you know, Lebensky, this, it simplifies, and in gravity too. The roadblock is quantum.
I mean, in a sense, the fact that you are rephrasing the boundary Hilbert story, Einstein-Hilbert story, should give you the same result, right? I mean, you just complexify and then you try to construct a theory from there. Yeah. And this should work. And what you get is something which is different from that. So, I mean, what I'm just saying is that the link between the four-dimensional Palatini and the three-dimensional Ashtekar is not really well proven.
Maybe just one more comment. If you work with triadic variables and go from the Einstein-Hilbert action on the so if you use your 3D metric gamma AB and use triadic fields, then at that point you have implicitly already solved some parts of the torsionless conditions, which are second class constraints, which are not showing up, which probably...
No, actually the torsionless constraints are pretty much first class in our so this DAE, EDAE equals to zero, this is a very well behaved object, and this actually reproduces gauge transformation. So
Hamiltonian vector. This in this dimensionality, wouldn't this condition imply this one that you wrote in the box? This number of dimensions.
What condition?
EDAE equals zero in this number of dimensions imply that there is some E hidden in there, right? The DAE, this one.
So this one is not obvious, and it's not obvious even if you require E to be a triad with no, let's say, transversal components. This, so in fact, if you say this equals zero, right? If you require that this is equal to zero, so Y is zero, then this is just a torsionless condition when A is some other connection.
So we will have lots of time for discussion in the afternoon, but I think we should let people get so much if they want to. So in the afternoon, we will at least sort of, I think, pick up with some more of some more gravity. I also wanted to announce that at 1:15 today in the atrium, there will be a 15-minute percussion performance. At 1:15 today, in the main atrium, there will be a short percussion performance.
There's a Foucault pendulum.
Yeah, there's also a Foucault pendulum. So it's that and percussion. I don't know. It says 1:15. So we should thank Michaela again.